Well, hoist with his own petard is a phrase from Shakespeare's play Hamlet. That's where it comes from. It's become kind of a proverb, a common saying. A petard is a small explosive device. So the phrase literally means that a bomb maker is blown up, hoisted off the ground by his own bomb. So it's a phrase about what we call poetic justice, right? Or an ironic reversal. And in our text today, spoiler alert, we already read it. I mean, Haman will be hoist with his own petard, right? That is, he'll be hung, he will be impaled on the very gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. And you'll recall that back in chapter 6, there was this extraordinary sleepless night for the king. Haman was seeking to have Mordecai executed early the next morning, but he ends up having to parade him around the city, declaring him to be the man whom the king delights to honor. This happens early on the day of our text today, here in chapter 7. It's the day after Esther's first banquet with the king and Haman, and the day of her second banquet with them. That's where we are. Haman goes home in great distress, and his wife and friends strangely, almost prophetically, tell him that if Mordecai's a Jew, you won't be able to stand against him, and that your fall has already been set in motion. And the king's eunuchs come, and they whisk Haman away to the second exclusive banquet at the beginning of our text. So he's had a humiliating day, but he's still the prime minister, right? He's still second in command, and surely he's hoping somehow to restore his dignity, right? To save face, to retain his power. Though he must be disoriented by the elevation of Mordecai and by his wife's and his advisor's counsel. Now, Esther, she has probably no idea of what almost happened to Mordecai, how close he came to being executed. Now, whether she knows that Mordecai was paraded around the city in honor or not, we don't know. But that's where we are at the beginning of chapter 7, and we'll make two points here. They're right there on page 4 in the bulletin, the request and the reversal. So first, the request. So the king and Haman, they go into Queen Esther's banquet, right? As the hostess, she's in charge. She's exercising her queenly authority. And they're drinking wine, as surely she had planned. She wants some alcohol in the king for the request that she's about to make. Now remember, to this point, she's basically made him commit already in public twice to giving her what she wants. And here comes the third time. The king says, "Queen Esther, what is your wish? It will be granted to you. What is your request? Even up to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Remember last time we pointed out that this up to half my kingdom is just hyperbole. The king's not giving half his kingdom away, right? It just means I'm in a good mood. What do you want? So this is the moment, right, for Esther. Surely she's terrified. She has to have practiced this hundreds of times, what she's finally going to say when he asks her. Now, if you want to know how scary this is, Herodotus, the Greek historian, tells a story, it's an incident, where a guy named Pythias, who was friendly to Ahasuerus, who had shown hospitality to this same king, Ahasuerus, who had contributed to his war chest, goes to the king and asks if he would release one of his 5 sons from military service, the oldest of the 5. And the king is so angered by the request that he has the boy cut in two. So these are deep and erratic and dangerous waters to make this request of the king. You're just used to the story. So she wades in and she says, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king." Now, even here, like, but before you get to the actual request, notice, this looks like introductory boilerplate language, but it's not. But in many ways, it's the heart of her appeal. She switches in this section from third-person language, you know, O King, which she used previously with the king, to much more intimate first and second person language. If I have found favor with you. Right? So she's appealing. The very heart of her argument is the personal bond, the closeness, that the favor with which the king views her, even if it's cooled some. And thinly veiled here is the attraction of her beauty, which the earlier part of the book is taken up with to some extent. So she cannot, and she does not here, make a high moral argument against genocide. Right? That would be futile. The king is likely not opposed to it. And in the empire, sometimes you argue on the empire's terms. In the world of sight, in the sensate culture of the court, where the king wants beautiful things to look at, Esther relies on the king's bond with her. She makes it personal. Right? His favor for her is not because they sit around reading Homer together at night. It has to do with her beauty. That's how she got there. Esther knows the power she's wielding here, and she's playing every card she has. If you look at this request, it's I have found favor, my wish, my life, my people. She very much fronts herself here. And she's made him pre-commit in public. She's got him inquisitive and anxious about this second banquet. She has him drinking, and now she appeals. Notice that the king asked the question this way. He said, what is your wish and what is your request? Well, that's just a flourish. He's just asking her for one thing. But she takes it as an opportunity to make two requests, which are bound together. She says, grant me my life, this is my wish, and spare my people, that is my request. So her fate and the fate of her people are now bound together. They're fused. Now those words right there, they have to set the king reeling. They have to be a shock. Esther and her people are in some kind of mortal danger? How would he know? He wouldn't know. He should know, but he doesn't know. She continues, for we have been sold, I and my people. Like, so at this point, Esther's like Moses. Right, interceding for Israel before God in Exodus 33. Moses pleads with the Lord in these very words, I and your people. Our prayers are always about us and the people of God. That's what the Lord's Prayer teaches us. Right? They're fused together. For I and my people have been sold, she says. And that's probably a reference to the money that Haman offered the king for this plan to kill the Jews. So here, and even here it's very subtle, like it's not explicit. She's probably revealing her Jewishness for the first time to the king. For I and my people have been sold. And notice what she does next. She quotes from the written decree. We have been sold to be destroyed and to be killed and to be annihilated. Those are the very words of the edict. So imagine the banquet, you're Haman sitting there at this banquet. Thinking, oh, I inadvertently threatened to kill the queen. Right? Haman now knows for sure that Esther's Jewish. And then she continues. This is an odd kind of argument. She continues in what I would say is less than true. It's faux self-effacing piece of nonsense. She says this. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have kept quiet. You know, it wouldn't have been worth bothering you over. Again, this is psychologically sophisticated. She's got a lot of leverage, and here's her closing argument. I'm so helpless. I hate to even bother you with this. This is all about your honor and your interests. I hate to disturb you. And then she finishes with this remarkable piece of convoluted calculus. She says, if we were merely sold into slavery, I would be silent about it, because our affliction, it's not to be compared with the loss to the king. It's a staggering argument. You think, here's the logic. It's actually hard to piece together what she's trying to say. The logic seems to be this. If we were enslaved, at least you'd get the free labor. But if you allow us, and I would have said nothing, but if you allow us to be killed, you'll lose all the economic benefit we could bring. You can only make this argument, right, with a deeply immoral human being for whom the lens of economic well-being is the key lens, right? If they had just sold us into slavery, I wouldn't even take any of your time up with this. She knows he could probably care less about her people, but she knows he cares about her. That's why it's me and my people. She knows that an attack on her is an attack on his honor and his majesty, and she's hoping that it will provoke him to anger. That's what she's trying to, and of course, the right kind of anger, guided anger, targeted at Haman, and it does. So in verse 5, the text tells you that the king asked Queen Esther. So they're together now. King and queen, majesties, over against a diminished Haman. Who is he? Where is he who has dared to do this? Now, like a lot of things in the book, this is also somewhat puzzling. Who has the king forgotten the genocide decree? It appears so. Maybe that's understandable. He didn't ask any questions about the people targeted when it was proposed, you'll recall. He just took off his signet ring, he gave it to Haman, and he apparently moved on. Right? He does a lot of business. I issue a lot of edicts. But seriously, when he says, who is he? You're the only one, O king, who could do this, even if you delegate it. You're the edict maker. Your signature is going to be on this kind of thing. Does he know about it, but not the fact that Esther would be targeted? Is he just trying to save face? It's probably best to say that the simplest explanation is he forgot the details, and he wants to know whose idea it was and who's carrying it out. So finally, Esther, having led the king on, creating anger and suspicion and across 2 days and two banquets, finally she says, a foe, an enemy, this wicked Haman, he's sitting right there. Now he's an adversary, not just of the Jews, but of the king as well, the way she's phrased this. And then Haman was terrified, we're told. Terrified before the team of the king and the queen. Terrified before a Jewess. So that's the request. The second point here we want to see is the reversal. This reversal's already in motion. But it begins with the king getting up from the banquet in a rage, leaving his wine, going out to the garden. Now, there's been a lot of speculation about what is going on here. And I think we can make a reasonably good guess. The king is thinking something like, how can I condemn Haman for his threat to my queen and thus to my honor if I am the one whose signature is on the irrevocable decree? Like, it's a little bit of a jam. So he didn't walk outside just to cool off, at least primarily. He walked out to figure out a way to save face and maybe to save the queen. Now, you would think that Haman would follow him out and explain that he didn't know Esther would be a target. I mean, after all, it is the king's edict. He could appeal to that. But Haman knows, from the way the king reacted at the table, he knows his fate's already sealed. You can see that in the text. It says he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. So he knows he's in trouble. Still, it's a tactical mistake to stay behind alone with Esther. But there was a regulation in the Persian Empire that inside the palace, men were to keep 7 steps distance from unaccompanied women. But he stays behind, the text says, to beg Queen Esther for his life. And earlier, he had celebrated Mordecai the Jew, and now he pleads with Esther the Jew. Very tough day for an anti-Semite. And notice what happens. Esther ignores his plea. The text is silent, and it appears she is silent as well. She won't show or ask for mercy from the king for Haman. Mercy is not hers to show. This is about the fate of her people. And what is going on here is that this is a form of holy war against an Amalekite enemy. Right? In the scope of the whole Bible, she will succeed where Saul failed. She will not have mercy on the Amalekite enemies of God. So she says nothing. And just as the king comes back from his banquet, and what does he see? He sees Haman, the text says, falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. They reclined on couches to banquet in this culture. Sounds very difficult to me, but somehow they did that. This word, so he's falling on the couch where Esther is. This word falling picks up key threads in the whole narrative, and it signals the ironic reversal. Mordecai refused to fall before Haman. Then the lot fell against the Jews. Then Haman's wife said he was beginning to fall to Mordecai. And now Haman falls on the couch where Esther is reclining. Now he is, of course, just pleading for mercy. Right? That's all he's doing. The king sees it, and surely the king knows that Haman is not really, at this moment, making a pass at the queen. But it provides the king with an excuse for judgment. It's a gift horse to the king. It gives him a way to get rid of Haman without reference to the decree at all. Right? In his moral calculus, molesting the queen with the king in his house may be worse than genocide anyway. So, it's like he says this, hey, we're dropping the genocide charge against you, but we're going to prosecute you for making a pass at my wife. It's like it's called selective prosecution. But it's good for the king. And by the way, there's another irony here. This king did not care at all about the sexual honor or dignity of his previous queen, Vashti. He was willing to have her parade around for his drunken friends. But now he pretends to care. He makes up this story that Esther's being assaulted in my very presence. It's all nonsense. But he uses it as a pretext to charge Haman with a rape or an assault of the queen, which would be a form of treason. And here's yet another irony. I mean, these pile up in the book of Esther. He who falsely accused the Jews of treason is now being falsely accused of treason himself. And as soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. He's now a condemned prisoner. But the sentence, like what the punishment is to be, is, shall we say, still up in the air. Which was a pun for those of you who are paying attention. Then one Harbona, a eunuch, states that Haman built a 75-foot gallows near his house. And he set it up for Mordecai, the same Mordecai who saved you from the assassination attempt. This, by the way, makes it sound like Haman was sympathetic to the assassins, the way the eunuch reports this. And it shows you that the Jews have won some favor inside the palace anyway. But one imagines Haman listening to this eunuch thinking, thanks, Harbona. Very helpful. Very helpful bringing the gallows to the king's attention. And the king says, hang him on that. And then they hoisted Haman on his own petard. They hung him on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. And the wrath of the king, arbitrary wrath, unjust wrath, abates. Ironically, now get this. This is irony number 75 in the book or something. Haman is executed for a crime he did not commit. Isn't that, it's amazing, right? He's executed for a crime. He did not sexually assault the queen. He didn't even willingly or knowingly target her life. He's hoisted with his own petard. And now again, by the king's will, as he was in the beginning of the book, he is truly elevated above all the officials. Which is another pun. The danger, it's bad when you have to tell people. The danger, however, is not over. The crisis is not resolved. The machinery of extermination remains in place. There are two chapters left in the book. But here's the key. The reversal at the heart of the empire is decisive. It will issue in the rescue of the people of God. So let me close with two things you can distill from this. We'll call them poetic justice and the petard. So first, poetic justice. Right? This idea of a grand ironic reversal is at the heart of God's providence. It's not like a thing chewing around the edges or the fringes of the Bible. It's a kind of principle built into the world by God's design. Here's Psalm 7. Listen to these words from Psalm 7. Whoever digs a hole and scoops it out falls into the very pit they have made. The trouble they cause recoils on them. Their violence comes down on their own heads. Right, this is why we rejoice when we see dictators and despots and malicious enemies fall. It's not because of malice on our part or because we take pleasure in other people's misfortune. It's because we have a deep, God-given thirst for justice. Right? We rejoice in the overturning of evil. If we didn't, we would be morally jaded. But poetic justice has two sides, right? Pride goes before the fall. Those who exalt themselves will be humbled. But the second side means the humble will be exalted and lifted up. God brings down the Hamans. He lifts up the Esthers and the Mordecais. And of course, this all culminates in Jesus Christ. Right at the heart of God's redemptive plan, you have Mary saying this of her pregnancy. That God has scattered those who are proud in their inmost thoughts. That he has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. This is before Jesus is even born. God has already, in the conception of his son in the womb of Mary, flipped the world upside down. He has filled the hungry with good things, and he has sent the rich away empty. And we heard this in the gospel lesson from Luke 6 this morning. Blessing on the weak and on the hungry, and woes to the rich and the powerful and the satisfied. Yes, it's true, this often seems hidden from us now and far away, and we only get an occasional glimpse of it. But we must believe God governs the moral order this way, or life would be unbearable for this. It won't be till the eschaton where we see the fullness of it, but at the eschaton, this will be fully manifested, this poetic justice, this reversal. It's the key to the restoration of all things. And that brings me to the petard. By the way, it's also a piece of political advice to know that this poetic justice is at work, because it reminds you things will be flipped right. Maybe now, maybe later, definitely at the end. Augustine famously said that in our political life, there are only two kinds of leaders. This is a comforting word. He said there are only two kinds of leaders. Dead ones and dying ones. It's the only kind of people that can be in office. Dying people or people who are already dead. So Augustine's point is these are vaporizing structures. They will be rectified. They will be made right. Sometimes we see it in history. But even when we don't, it's at the heart of the gospel. Because it's at the heart of Mary's prayer. The second point then is the petard, right? The cross is the devil's petard. The pole he built for Jesus upon which he himself is impaled. So at the cross is the poetic justice at the heart of reality. Like Augustine says this, the devil was defeated by his own victorious achievement. He was exultant when Christ died, and by that very death the devil was conquered. And then he continues using these analogies that the church fathers were fond of. He says this, it's as though he took the bait in a mousetrap. The mousetrap for the devil was the cross of the Lord. The bait by which he would be caught was the death of the Lord. Right? In the words of our New Testament lesson, Christ shared in our humanity so that, and this is the key phrase, so that by his death he might destroy death and break the power of the one who had the hold on death, the devil. So Haman, who was a devil, who was a snake, he and all the Babylons that those like him administer, they are doomed. They will be hoisted on their own petards. Maybe not in history, but often in history if you wait long enough. But most definitely at the end. We are sure of this because it's built into God's providence. And because it's built into God's atoning mercy. Christ was hoisted. He was lifted up on the petard that we deserved. That's the key thing to see. We are Haman in this analogy. We should be up on that gallows. But we're not. Jesus Christ is there in our place. with all of our Haman-like monstrosities and our Haman-like pomposity and our Haman-like pride, we should be up there on that gallows. And Jesus is hoist on it in our place for the judgment of all the principalities and powers of evil, so that he might be lifted up, so that he could draw all men to himself, so that he could effect the salvation of the world. A salvation which is from the preserved and protected Jews. Glory be to God, the God of this deep irony, the God of the last laugh. Amen.